Perhaps someone among these 3,000 men waiting in the mud had run into Hals or Lenson or the veteran, stretched out on an armful of long, soaking stalks, dreaming of a distant utopia, indifferent to the rain running down his resigned features. But my researches were in vain, and my questions remained unanswered. Once I thought I recognized a couple of faces from our disbanded company. I talked to the fellows, who answered evasively that they no longer remembered anything that had happened. They were absolutely exhausted, and my questions only seemed to annoy them. Their stunned minds seemed capable of only one idea: they had to cross the river. There was only one person who might know a little more than the others, Herr Captain Wesridow. But the respect and fear which officers required of us made it almost impossible to speak to them. A few of the older soldiers were bold enough to approach them, but for a boy like myself it was entirely different. However, I was so consumed by desire to speak to the captain that it must have showed on my face. Also, I was always lingering somewhere near him or his group. I was sitting on my bundle a short distance away from Wesridow and two or three other officers, including a major, when Wesridow began to walk toward me. I stared in confusion at the tall figure in the long leather coat shining with rain, ready to leap to my feet and snap to attention. But the captain gestured to me to stay as I was, so I remained on the ground, with my eyes glued to his face. He seemed even taller than usual, because I was so low down. "What regiment do you belong to, young fellow?" he asked. I stammered out my regimental number, as well as the number of the scratch company I was taken into for the retreat from Kona Top. He took me for a Czech, so I explained my origins to him. Was all he said about that. Those scratch companies were the last ones out. I led several of them myself. "I know, Herr Hauptmann," I said, blushing. "I saw you." I couldn't get used to the idea that the captain really was talking to me.
"Ah," said Wesridow, "then we have memories in common, of a difficult time.
Ah, Herr Hauptmann." He reached for a cigarette, but the packet was empty. Had he perhaps been going to offer me one? "We'll be crossing tomorrow, young fellow, and I expect you'll be getting a long leave." The word "leave" was like a sudden sip of champagne.
"Leave?
I think so. We won't have stolen it from you." Sensations which I had thought I would never feel again immediately revived all the emotions I had buried with so much difficulty. Could it be possible? But it had always been possible. How could I doubt it? I suddenly realized the full weight of my despair. How absolutely I had given up hope. Now I began to think again, timidly and gently, of Paula. Since we had been organized into the special assault group, there had been no mail. Although we had been moving continuously, this lack of news had weighed on me terribly. And then, in the face of such intense misery and disgust, words describing love and tenderness lost their meaning. Everything I had felt seemed to have been swept away in the dust and noise of crumbling houses, and in misery far more intense than the miseries of love. I had often thought that if I managed to live through the war, one wouldn't expect too much of life. How could one resent disappointment in love if life itself was constantly in doubt? Since Belgrade, terror had overturned all my preconceptions, and the pace of life had been so intense one no longer knew what elements of ordinary life to abandon in order to maintain some semblance of balance. I was still unresigned to the idea of death, but I had already sworn to myself during moments of intense fear that I would exchange anything: fortune, love, even a limb, if I could simply survive. I sensed that Captain Wesridow was about to leave, so I asked him if he knew anything of my usual companions. He was only able to remember the veteran, calling him by his proper name. August Wiener's company was supporting a howitzer battery at the beginning of the offensive. The first troops had a hard time. It was very difficult. In any case, the men who got through were probably sent to Kiev. That's where we would have regrouped if we'd had the trucks. I listened to him in silence. He nodded, and walked away. "We'll be crossing tomorrow." My head was spinning with the thought of a leave, and with the anguish of the possible loss of my special comrades. Perhaps I had already walked past their burnt bodies on the shattered pavement of the Kona Top Kiev road.
Would I also have to renounce the friendships which had seen me through so much? I knew that they also were so close to being stripped of everything that the sentiment I had for them seemed permissible, it was so gratuitous and disinterested. Must I also obliterate, without remorse, for remorse is a dangerous luxury in battle, the memories of Hals, and Lenson, and even that bastard Lindbergh? However, if my friends had disappeared, the veteran had left me an inheritance, a special faculty. I would relive all my good memories, even in the worst moments, and lie on the ground, inert and almost insensible, oblivious of the rain which my saturated cap was no longer able to soak up, and which ran over my face and collar and down my neck. The rain streaming across my cheeks would take the place of the tears I should have shed. The rain continued for a long time, through the night and the next day, until the end of the afternoon. The soil on which we waited had become a giant sponge. Each fresh bundle of rushes soaked up as much water from the ground as it received from the sky. We were so thoroughly soaked through that some of us stripped altogether, to wait naked. Most of the time, we stayed on our feet, with tent cloths over our shoulders, watching the endless back and forth of the rafts. Toward noon, despite the terrible weather, a squadron of Ilocians appeared. Once again, we cursed those birds of ill omen, which forced us to lie with our noses in the gluey Dnieper mud. The planes made three passes, scattering bombs and bullets wherever they could see anything. Once again, we were filled with a panic which ended only when the list of killed and wounded had grown a little longer. Finally, toward 6 in the evening, as the light was fading, our group was taken in charge by the transit services. We were ordered to collect our things and proceed in good order to the three embarkation points which the incessant trampling had transformed into an astonishing quagmire. Carrying our arms and baggage, covered with slimy mire, we set off down the road despite the mud which threatened to engulf us. With heroic patience and discipline, each man waited his turn, enduring the torrential rain without complaint. With our feet in the muddy water, our boots could no longer resist. We kept our assigned places. The last men to embark had to wait for several hours. Vague, momentary smiles lit our almost unrecognizable faces. At last we were going to cross, and all of this would be over. We would be able to dry ourselves, and sleep, perhaps even in comfort, and stop feeling afraid. We clung to our more hopeful thoughts, although we were haunted by one last fear. What would happen on the trip across? Would the overused, overloaded boats make it? Or would they sink, carrying 100 desperate souls to the bottom? And then there were the Yabos. If any Russian planes appeared, we could all remember in clear detail the horrible massacre of the day before. Then it grew dark. Russian planes rarely flew at night, so perhaps we were at least safe from them. When it was my turn, I climbed with 100 other men onto a raft whose planks had been splintered by the passage of thousands of hobnailed boots. I watched anxiously as the water rose to within a foot of swamping us. "That's enough, Captain," shouted a non-com who looked about 40 years old. "Do you want us to sink?" "As many as possible, SPS," an engineer said, laughing. "That's orders, and we are used to it. Come on, let's have another 10. When we were on the point of foundering, the boatman let go of the ropes and, with the agility of young goats, jumped onto the few inches they had reserved for themselves. So slowly we were almost unaware of it, the raft began to move out onto the water, which was barely greased by our momentum. Our balance seemed so precarious that no one dared move. The cursed bank, veiled in fog, disappeared from sight. I was huddled in the center of the raft between two fellows I didn't know, a young lieutenant from an infantry regiment which had come to help us at Konotop, and a fellow from my own company, who seemed to be asleep on his feet. He was the only one who seemed so indifferent. Everyone else was listening and looking intently, especially toward the rainy sky, which we mistrusted absolutely. A boat half the size of ours, but with the same engine, slowly pulled level with us. Its deck was as jammed as ours. How long was the crossing? Perhaps a quarter of an hour. It seemed interminable. The water slid past us with an easy, regular motion, whose slowness made us frantic. Some of the fellows were counting aloud, marking off the seconds perhaps, or using them as one uses imaginary sheep, to force sleep. Then voices announced the approach of the West Bank and safety and release from our torments. The men at the front of the raft could see it, enveloped in fog. Our blood ran faster in our veins, as we tried, by willpower, to increase the speed of the engine. We were about to land, to be safe quick, while the sky was still quiet. An empty raft crossed our path, heading back for the east bank. We looked at it coldly. Any movement toward the east made us shiver. Then the west bank was only 20 yards away. We no longer dared to move for fear of foundering, despite an intense joy which we would have expressed in other circumstances by jumping and shouting. After so many days and hours of waiting and despair, we had been saved. Then there were only 10 yards. Then 5. The engines went into reverse, to slow us down. We drew up beside a pier made of tied branches, and we heard voices telling us to move slowly and carefully. With a sense of enormous privilege, we stepped, one after the other, onto the solid earth, which is to say, onto a quagmire exactly like the east bank. But the mud no longer mattered, we had crossed to the other side. The west bank meant security and safety, a barrier between us and the Russians. We had dreamed of this safety for so long, and so intensely, that we almost felt as if there were a barrier between us and the war itself. The bulletins had been official, we would hold on to the Dnieper. The enemy would not pass beyond that line, and in the spring we would push them back beyond the Volga. During our long and painful retreat to the river and our endless wait, our thoughts had crystallized around this idea, and actually stepping onto the West Bank seemed like the end of our misfortune. Reorganization, clean clothes, leave, and the assurance that we had not been beaten. Of course, the West Bank was still Russia, but it was the part of Russia which had welcomed us a few years earlier, the part of Russia which really favored us. Our exhausted brains clung to this fantasy. The West Bank was almost the motherland. Part 4, To the West, Winter 1943 to Summer 1944, got MITUNS. The officers and soldiers waiting to direct us were not particularly agreeable, and the military police, with their badges glistening damply in the fog, were downright unpleasant. All organizations have police, and some of them must be fine fellows. However, we wanted to forget the police at Romy, and on the retreat from the Don, to preserve some of the joy we felt at being back in the West. We tramped along, herded by a couple of fellows in a sidecar covered with mud. They didn't bother to line us up in threes, but let us walk any way we liked, almost as if we were out for a stroll, which was a pleasant variation of usual practice. Maybe they knew what a hard time we'd had, and had decided to give us a break. Now that we were out of it, maybe everything was going to be all right. The sidecar forced us to increase our pace. We went on for about a mile and a half, stumbling through the mud and splattering our companions, to arrive finally at a big camp, where the men who'd crossed ahead of us were already waiting. It was dark and a fine rain was falling. We could see the barbed wire gleaming with wetness. Two soldiers with machine guns under their arms waved us through a makeshift entrance. Then we stopped, and the sidecar drove rapidly away. We stood where we'd been left, surrounded by barbed wire, not knowing what to think. We tried to tell ourselves that this was just how things happened in the army, and that this welcome seemed excessively cold because we were fresh from the hell of Konotop. They were probably making us wait so that they could take us straight to clean, comfortable barracks, where we would sleep and regain our strength. Or perhaps they were getting our passes ready. This last idea filled us with joy, and annihilated the liquid mud, and the rain, and the barbed wire, which in reality held us prisoner. We waited for about 2 hours. A second group of new arrivals joined us. The rain had become heavier, and we were all streaming with water. Quite nearby, we could see a row of huts with firm roofs and weather-tight windows, to which men were being sent in groups of 20. We waited expectantly, certain that we were living through the last of our miseries. The fellows who went into the huts weren't coming out again. They must already be sleeping on soft beds, the lucky bastards. An hour later, it was my turn, along with 19 others. There were 2 non-coms and a lieutenant in our group. We went into the building, which had its own generator and was brightly lit. Our state of extreme filth suddenly made us feel awkward. Military men of all ranks and military police were sitting facing us behind a row of long tables. An Obergefreiter came up to us, yelling as in the old days at training camp. He told us to get over to the tables to be screened. We should be ready to produce on demand the papers and equipment entrusted to us by the army. This reception only increased our sense of astonished unease. "First, your documents," an MP shouted across the table. The lieutenant, who was directly ahead of me in the line, was being interrogated. "Where is your unit, lieutenant?" "Annihilated, Herr Gendarme. Missing or dead." We had a hard time. The MP said nothing to this, but went on leafing through the lieutenant's papers. "Did you leave your men, or were they killed?" The lieutenant hesitated for a moment. We were all watching in frozen silence. "Is this a court-martial?" The lieutenant's voice was exasperated. "You must answer my questions, Herr Lieutenant. Where is your unit?" The lieutenant clearly felt caught in a trap, as did we all. Very few of us could have answered that question with any precision. He tried to explain. But there is never any point in explaining to an MP. Their powers of comprehension are always limited to the form they wish to fill. Further, it appeared that the lieutenant was missing a great many things. This fact obsessed his interrogator. It didn't matter that the man in front of him was effecting a miracle simply by staying on his feet, and had lost at least 30 pounds since entering the army. The MP only noted that the Zeiss field glasses, which are part of an officer's equipment, were missing. Also missing were a map case, and the section telephone, for which the lieutenant was responsible. In fact, the lieutenant, who had managed to save only his life, was missing far too many things. The army did not distribute its papers and equipment only to have them scattered and lost. A German soldier is expected to die rather than indulge in carelessness with army property. The careless lieutenant was assigned to a penal battalion, and 3 grades were stripped from his rank. At that, he could think himself lucky. The lieutenant's eyes were wild, and he seemed to be fighting for breath. He was a pitiful and terrifying sight. 2 soldiers dragged him off to the right, toward a group of broken men, who'd been dealt with in the same way. Then it was my turn. I felt stiff with fright. I pulled my crumpled documents from an inside pocket. The MP riffled through them, throwing me a reproving look. His bad temper seemed to soften somewhat at the sight of my apprehensive, mortified face, and he continued his inventory in silence. Fortunately, I had been able to reintegrate with my unit, and had saved the scrap of white cardboard which stated that I had left the infirmary to take part in an attack. My head was swimming, and I thought I was going to faint. Then the MP read off a list of articles which ordinary soldiers like myself were supposed to carry at all times. The words rolled off his tongue, but I didn't catch them quickly enough, and didn't immediately produce the items still in my possession. The MP then treated me to a certain German word, which I was hearing for the first time. It appeared I was missing 4 items, including that fucking gas mask I had deliberately abandoned. My paybook was passed from hand to hand to be inspected and stamped. In my panic, I made an idiotic move. Hoping to gain favor, I produced 9 unused cartridges from my cartridge belt. The MP's eyes lit on these like the eyes of an alpinist who spots a good foothold. "You were retreating? Ah, Herr Unteroffizier. Why didn't you try to defend yourself? Why didn't you fight?" he shouted. "Herr Unteroffizier. What do you mean? We were ordered to retreat, Herr Unteroffizier. God damn it to hell!" he roared. "What kind of an army runs without shooting?" My paybook came down the line. My interrogator grabbed it, and riffled the pages for a moment. His eyes traveled from the filthy, tattered page to my face. I followed the movement of his lips, which might be about to assign me a penal battalion to the life of a prisoner, to forward positions, mine clearing, infrequent leaves always confined to camp, so that the word liberty lost all meaning, and the cancellation of mail. I held back my tears with difficulty. Finally the M.P.'s rigid fingers handed back my liberty. I had not been assigned to a penal battalion, but my emotion overwhelmed me anyway. As I picked up my pack, I sobbed convulsively, unable to stop. A fellow beside me was doing the same. The crowd of men still waiting stared at me in astonishment. Like a miserable tramp, I ran past the line of tables and left by a door opposite the one we'd entered by. I felt that I had disgraced myself. I rejoined my comrades, who were standing in the rain in the other part of the camp. They weren't resting on the soft beds we dreamed of before coming to this place, and the rain streaming down their shoulders and backs was another hope disappointed. However, despite the slap in the face we had just received from our grateful country, we could still count ourselves lucky. 3 days later, we learned that the day after our crossing, with 6,000 or 7,000 of our men still waiting on the east bank, the Russians had attacked. They were probably discouraged by their failure to retake Kiev, where the heavily outnumbered German army was fighting desperately, and had decided to clean up the pockets still occupied by the Wehrmacht. 24 hours after our group left, our comrades on the east bank were suddenly dazzled by the flares that flooded their temporary encampments with brilliant light. The lookouts in the shallow trenches scratched into the hills overlooking the river, who were supposed to provide an illusion of protection, watched the shouting hordes of Russian infantry flood down to the river. These soldiers quickly realized they would never be able to stop that irresistible tide, and succumbed to a moment of absolute panic. Some ran, through the deafening explosions of Soviet rockets which drowned out our Spandaus and light mortars. The Russians, driven by expectations of victory and by the exhortations of the people's commissars, pushed forward regardless of the cost. The cost was enormous. Each German projectile seemed to hit home. But Ivan continued his inexorable advance. On the mud landing stage from which I had embarked, panic gave way to madness. One of the rafts, which was loading up as usual, was swamped by a human flood. The few who managed to keep cool heads shouted for calm, and sometimes even used their guns. In the grotesque, trampling rush, mooring ropes gave way, and the raft drifted out a few yards, shuddering under the weight of the mob which had overrun it. Hands trying to grip the edges of the raft were trampled and crushed by heavy boots. On the landing stage, friends were fighting each other. Some of the officers committed suicide. The raft moved out another couple of yards, and then suddenly tipped away from the bank like a child's toy. A loud cry mingled with the sound of the approaching battle, and 200 terrified men floundered in the water, clinging together or trying to swim. A great many sank and drowned instantly. At that moment, Ivan appeared at the crest of the hills, having swept the defenders aside. Drunk with excitement, the Russian soldiers dropped to the ground on one knee, and picked off Germans as if they were clay pigeons at a fair. A few Germans, white as ghosts, fired back with their FMS, but their numbers were so small the Russians scarcely noticed them. Several thousand others were running, screaming, trying to get away, and dying as they ran. The Russians also fired at the men in the water who were trying to swim, using flares to light the darkness. An hour after they had appeared on the skyline, the Russians reached the river. There were a few more scattered shots, but their victory was complete. A third of the remaining German troops were taken prisoner, and for the rest everything was over. Their military responsibilities had come to an end, and they would never again be victimized by military police. At the reception camp, we stood in the rain a little longer, and then three blacked-out trucks appeared to collect us. Despite the appalling road and the overload which threatened to burst the slatted sides, 50 soldiers wrapped in sacking were piled onto each truck with all their equipment. I was stuffed into one of these human ant heaps, that is to say, one leg was buried in the swarm, while the other dangled out. I was astride the back flap, but there were other fellows hanging on for dear life who were almost entirely outside the truck. We rolled off through the quiet night. I felt completely disoriented, and hadn't the faintest sense of our direction. An hour later, we drew up to a group of buildings, which first appeared as a vague, blurred mass in the dim, bluish light. We realized that an unusual rush of activity was taking place all around, and then gradually perceived that we were looking at a row of structures bordered on both sides by tree-lined roads jammed with innumerable vehicles. There were troops everywhere, on foot or arriving and leaving on high-speed motorcycles, and many officers and MPs. The trucks jerked to a sudden halt, and we were told to get off. Although we still understood that we'd been saved, we were beginning to feel that we'd had enough. We were famished and dropping with sleep. We had to wait for another half hour before someone came to take charge of us. The rain fell steadily. Was it raining anywhere else? Was it raining in France? I tried to think of my house and my bed. Where were they now? In which direction? But I could only summon up confused and fragmented memories of the life I had left behind. My only world was the vast anonymity of Russia, which seemed to be engulfing all of us, absorbing entire regiments, so that even their names vanished. Finally, a non-com came over to us. Our group leader handed him our papers, which he examined with a dimmed flashlight. Then he ordered us to collect our gear and follow him. At last, we entered the shelter of a roof, an amenity to which we'd grown so unaccustomed that we stared at it as if it were the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. "You'll be sent to your units later," shouted the non-com, who, like the rest of us, seemed to have had just about enough. "While you're waiting, try to get a little rest." He didn't have to repeat himself. We explored the darkness of the but with our pocket flashlights, and discovered that it contained a couple of benches and four or five large tables. Everyone stretched out where he could, making pillows of the nearest leg, or buttocks, or boot. The discomfort seemed unimportant beside the fact that at last we were out of the rain. Some fellows began to snore immediately, others tried to pretend they were somewhere else. Despite our harsh reception, we all had a sense that from now on everything would go better, and that once again life was offering its possibilities. We all thought of the leave we would surely be getting, which was now only a question of patience. However, soldiers fresh from the front cannot indulge the luxury of daydreams. The accumulated lack of sleep gripped our temples like an iron band. Like people suffering a serious illness, we dropped swiftly from consciousness into deep sleep. We probably slept for a long time. It was broad daylight when a burst of noise suddenly woke us. Then a long blast of a whistle ordered us to our feet. We were all filthy and horribly crumpled. If the Führer had seen us, he would either have sent us all home or had us shot. The non-com who had waked us looked at us with an expression of surprise. Perhaps he too had never imagined that the German army could be reduced to such a state. He spoke to us, but I no longer remember what he said. I was still only half awake, and understood that he was talking, without really listening to him. We gathered that we were to prepare for departure. We were going to be returned to our units. One of the huts had been fitted with showers, but so many men were waiting that we clearly had no chance of getting inside. Instead, we were given some empty gasoline vats full of hot water. However, we all felt too exhausted to want to Washington our days of training, when we were appalled by the smallest spot on our tunics, seen very far away. Our concern had shifted from hygiene to something far more urgent. Furthermore, it was bitterly cold, and no one wanted to take anything off, not even the sacking draped over our shoulders. I was so cold I was shivering, and I wondered if I was getting sick again. We had to go outside for food, and lined up like a column of tramps beside the field kitchen. A cold east wind was blowing damp patches of fog in from the river. Two cooks emptied large ladles of hot soup into our chipped and filthy mess tins. We had been expecting the usual ersatz, but it seemed that the time for that had long gone by. As a special gesture, they were serving us 11 o'clock soup early. The burning hot mixture made us feel much better. A Hauptmann stared at us as he walked by, and then turned back, obviously looking for our unit leader. The lieutenant who filled this position got up and walked over to him. Kamerad, the captain said, you and your men have been given this opportunity to clean up. I think you should make the most of it. Jorwell, Herr Hauptmann,